You're listening to the Religions of the Ancient Mediterranean podcast. This is the series Honoring the Gods in the Roman Empire. I'm Phil Harlan, a prof at York University in Toronto. In this episode, I'm going to be discussing imperial cults. Imperial cults, or worship of the emperors, were an important aspect of life in cities of Rome and Asia Minor, we will soon see. And I'll be explaining today some of the ways in which these honors for the emperors as gods were integrated within cultural, religious, and social life and political life in Asia Minor. In arguing that these honors for the emperors were integrated within religious and cultural life, I'm actually working against a common viewpoint of some scholarship in the past. Scholars such as A.D. Nock and M.P. Nilsson, for example, who were quite influential in the study of Greco-Roman religion, and who continue to influence some people who study Greco-Roman religion, would suggest to you that the imperial cults were quite different in kind from honors for other gods in the Roman Empire, and that they were primarily political, not religious, they were primarily public, not private, and that they generally lacked genuine religiosity, would be the way that some of these scholars would speak about this. Now, there's a variety of reasons why this viewpoint, this older scholarly viewpoint on imperial cults is problematic, including the fact that there's not much time spent theorizing about what religion is and explaining what religion is generally in terms of its concept. And therefore, they're working often with unstated assumptions about what religion is and often imposing on antiquity modern concepts of religion that focus on individualism, the idea of the individual's personal experience being the center of religion. In one of my articles in Ancient History Bulletin, Imperial Cults Within Local Cultural Life, Associations in Rome and Asia, I put this way. Underestimating the social and religious significance of imperial cults for the populace is partially the result of the imposition of modern viewpoints and assumptions onto ancient evidence. First, the traditional view reflects modern distinctions between politics and religion, which, as Price also stresses, do not fit the ancient context, where the social, religious, economic, and political were intricately interconnected and often inseparable. Second, the view involves, in part, the imposition of modern notions concerning individualism, private versus public, and related definitions of religion onto ancient evidence. Some modern definitions of religion, such as those offered by William James and Rudolf Otto, stress emotions or feelings of the individual as the heart of religion, emphasizing an equation between personal or private and genuine religiosity. And there is a tendency among some scholars to apply this to antiquity. However, such individualistic and sometimes anti-ritualistic definitions of religion are problematic when applied to non-Western or even non-Protestant religious phenomena, modern or ancient, as we shall see. Even so, there is neglected evidence that imperial cults were important within contexts that many of these scholars would consider private, including the associations. So that problem that we've raised earlier in the series regarding problems in defining religion and problems with the imposition of modern concepts of religion as a personal, experiential thing are once again causing problems in the study of things like honoring the emperors as gods in places like Rome and Asia Minor. But let me just read for you a couple comments by Nilsson, for example, that we'll generally be working against in this discussion here of imperial cults. According to Nilsson, for example, imperial cult, quote, lacked all genuine religious content, end quote. The cult's, quote, meaning lay far more in state and social realms where it served both to express loyalty to the rule of Rome and the emperor and to satisfy the ambition of the leading families. Moreover, imperial rituals were merely ceremony, quote, a purely mechanical exercise, which failed to evoke the feelings or emotions of the individuals who participated. In other words, Nilsson talks as though no one actually believed that the emperors were gods, and this is reflected in the lack of any what he calls private forms of religious life and the lack of genuine mysteries. We'll soon be returning to this question of mysteries in honor of the emperors as gods, there's nothing categorically different about the mysteries that are done in honor of the emperors as gods in the way that Nielsen suggests here. So we're working against this tendency to dismiss honoring emperors as gods, to dismiss it as though it's merely political and does not have much meaning within cultural and social and religious realms. I'm going to suggest that honors for the emperors as God were well integrated within social and religious life. What we can say is that the same cultic honors that we see in honor of the gods generally, in honor of Zeus, in honor of Artemis, in honor of Asclepius, that the same range of activities were done in honor of those gods that we also find in honor of the emperors as gods. As you probably know, we can't get into the minds of ancient people to find out did they really believe the emperors were gods, which has often been a misguided exploration of scholarship in the past. Did they believe that they were gods? What we can say is that the practices that people engaged in relation to the emperors were the same kinds of practices that were done in relation to traditional gods, and that this indicates to us that the emperors were considered gods in the worldview of the people who are participating here. Let me explain to you some of the main scholarship you can take a look at on your own if you would like. A very influential book in the study of imperial cult in Asia Minor specifically is Simon Price's Rituals and Power, The Roman Imperial Cult in Asia Minor. This book was written back in 1984, and there's a sense in which Price's book made a massive change in the direction in which imperial cults were studied, such that now imperial cults are taken more seriously, you could say, and not dismissed as readily as merely political, and that scholars of religion and social life in the Roman Empire now consider studying worship of the emperors as an important aspect of understanding how gods were honored in the Roman Empire. So you can take a look at Simon Price. A very recent book that touches on early Christianity, but also does a very good job of explaining imperial cults on their own, is Stephen Friesen's Imperial Cults and the Apocalypse of John. You may also know that I myself have done a bit of scholarship relating to imperial cults in the ancient world, especially in Rome and Asia Minor. You can check out my book, Associations, Synagogues, and Congregations. Today I just want to briefly explain to you four main types of imperial cult, you could say, or four main levels at which honors for the emperors as gods take place in the Roman Empire, and then we'll zoom in on Asia Minor for examples of three of these types. Remember that there's some interaction between these different types, and I wouldn't take this too restrictively in the way that you approach it. But basically, the four main types I want to talk about are, first of all, the practices associated with deceased emperors centered in Rome, and the official public cults for the deceased emperors that took place in the city of Rome itself. The second level that I want to talk about, or the second type of imperial cults, are cults in honor of the emperors as gods that take place and are organized by a province. The third level that I want to mention is civic imperial cults, namely that locally in specific cities in Asia Minor, you can find temples and shrines that have been established by local families, wealthy families who have contributed money towards setting up a temple in honor of the emperors as gods. The fourth main type of imperial cults, the fourth level at which you will find the emperors honored as gods, are what you could call local cults, cults that take place within small group settings. Associations, specifically, is what I have in mind here. There's a sense in which this final category, the associations, provides the clearest evidence of the way in which honoring the emperors as gods is integrated within social and cultural life at the local level. That it's not from the top down that honors for the emperors take place, but rather from the bottom up. That it's more of a, you could call, grassroots. Some forms of honoring the gods as emperors were more grassroots than others. And we'll soon see that those examples in the associations in the local level are our best evidence to work against the traditional scholarly view, which dismisses imperial cults as mere political wrangling. Let me explain each of those levels a little bit now. We won't spend as much time on the first one as we will on the last three. In the city of Rome itself, there was a tradition associated with the Principate. Once there was a sole ruler beginning with Augustus, there began to be a tradition that once the emperor died, the emperor could, through a specific ceremony that took place, be considered to have joined the gods. And so we have the apotheosis, as it is called, of the emperor. After he has died, he can be considered by the Senate and then by the official public cults in the city of Rome itself as having gone up to be among the gods. And this is partly because of the history of Rome as a republic, that there was a hesitancy on the part of senators and of those in the highest upper classes in the Roman imperial order to recognize living emperors as gods, at least in an official public way. Recent work by a scholar named Itai Gradel has actually shown that there is considerable evidence for the worship of living emperors in Rome and in Italy generally, but not in the officially run public cults of the city of Rome itself. So he has shown that there is considerable evidence for the worship of the emperors while they're alive nonetheless, even in the West. Traditionally in the past, it was always contrasted that in the Western part of the empire, the emperors are only honored after they're deceased, honored as gods after they're deceased, and that in the Greek part of the empire, it was the practice to honor the living emperors as gods. This contrast needs to be broken down a bit and needs to be qualified heavily, we now know, based on Itai Gradel's work on this very subject. He has shown how the emperors were worshipped as gods while they were alive within a variety of settings in Italy and in Rome, within a variety of unofficial settings, including associations and within the family setting. So that at least gives you a quick view of Rome itself and what's going on there at that level. Let's talk now about provincial imperial cults. Remember that the Roman Empire is divided up into different provinces, and that in this podcast we've been focusing mainly on the province of Asia in Western Asia Minor. Now these provinces would sometimes organize themselves more fully and have representatives from different cities of the province and have a council. The council of the province of Asia would have representatives from the wealthy classes of different cities throughout the province of Asia. Now, in the first century BCE, late first century BCE, this council that formulated began to have an interest in having the emperors specifically honored. As time went on, this became more and more organized how to run these provincial imperial cults. And so temples were established in various cities of Asia Minor by this provincial body. And the officials that were in charge of the imperial cults, at least by the time you get to the late first century CE, the officials within the provincial organization were known as the high priests of Asia, or the high priestesses of Asia. We do have examples of women taking on this position on behalf of the provincial communities. In the first century BCE, we first of all have the earliest one set up in Pergamum. This one was in honor of Roma personified, the goddess Roma, and God Augustus, established in 29 BCE in Pergamum. We then have four others that were established in the first century CE, just to give an example. At Smyrna, there's a temple for Tiberius, the emperor, in 26 CE. At Miletus, we have evidence, inscriptional evidence from the late 30s or early 40s that shows that there was a temple temporarily set up for the very disliked emperor Caligula. After he was dead, they got rid of this temple and sort of shut down the cult. And finally, we have in 89 CE, an official temple for the Sebastoi set up in Ephesus. This last one is fairly significant here for understanding the future direction from the late first century on of how the emperors are honored as gods in Asia Minor. The term that is usually used for the emperors as gods is Sebastoi. This is the Greek equivalent of the Augusti. Remember that Augustus is a title that is given to the emperors, with the first emperor sort of going by that name on its own. Means something along the lines of revered one or if it's Sebastoi plural, we're talking about the revered ones, the emperors revered as gods. And so this Sebastoi term, honoring the Sebastoi, honoring the revered ones, becomes the common way of expressing honors for the emperors as gods in Asia Minor. So there's more of a corporate understanding of the emperors and of the imperial family generally as the revered ones to which sacrifices can be given and honors can be given in a variety of different settings. Another example of what this provincial council would do in connection with honors for the emperors as gods is given by a particular inscription that is quite interesting for the way in which it reorganizes time so that the whole calendar of Roman Asia was changed in order to be specifically honoring to the first emperor, Augustus. This inscription that we're looking at here is in the collection Orientis Graeci Inscriptionis Selectae, OGIS as it is known, number 458. And this is an inscription that was originally inscribed in 10 or 9 BCE, and it has to do with rearranging the calendar of the whole province. And so the representatives from the different cities of Asia get together in this provincial council that we're talking about, and the provincial council is involved in reorganizing the calendar for all of the cities of Roman Asia in a way that would honor Augustus specifically, namely by changing the beginning of the year to the birthday of Augustus on September 23rd. It's an interesting way in which this came about. We have evidence in this inscription. We first of all have part of the letter of the proconsul of Asia that relates to these honors, but also the whole decree of the provincial assembly, the provincial council that we've been talking about, the Greeks in the province of Asia, as they call it. In this decree, it's hinted at several times that there had been a contest. So the provincial council set up a contest. Whoever could come up with the best way of honoring Augustus would be rewarded in a particular way for coming up with the idea. And so the winner of this contest, it turns out, and this is a bit hard to know how this came about, ended up being the Roman proconsul. The imperial governor of Asia ends up being the winner for the contest. And the suggestion he made is that the birthday of the most divine Caesar be, in other words, of Augustus, be the beginning of the new year for all of the cities of Roman Asia, and that this is the optimum way of honoring Augustus as a god. Here's some of the text from the proconsul's proclamation after he won the contest. We should justly assume his birthday, Augustus's birthday, to be equivalent to the beginning of all things. And he has restored to usefulness, if not to their natural state, whatever institutions have become imperfect or fallen into misfortune. And he has given a different appearance to the whole world, which would merely have accepted destruction if Caesar had not been born for the common blessing of all. And since it happens that in almost all the cities in Asia, there exists the same day for assuming magistracies, the civic positions, a system obviously prearranged according to some divine plan, so that it might be the starting point of honor to Augustus. And since it is difficult to render thanks properly for Augustus's great benefactions, unless in each case we should devise some novel manner of repaying him, therefore men should celebrate his birthday with greater pleasure as a holiday common to all. So this will be the New Year's Day. They're changing when New Year's Day happens in order to honor Augustus in a particular way here. Now, we also have the Council of Asia's proclamation, its decree regarding this, that once again has more of this and the way it's talking about the wonderful benefactions of the emperor mirrors the types of honors that were attributed to gods. And remember, we're still within that whole system of honor and benefaction that is the basis of how culture works in Roman Asia Minor, with the emperors and gods in this case at the very height of the cosmic hierarchy as the ultimate benefactors who bring good things and who therefore deserve divine honors. Here's the decree of the province of Asia, the representatives from different cities. It was decreed by the Greeks in the province of Asia on the motion of the high priest Apollonius son of Menophilus, whereas providence which divinely has arranged our lives has with special zeal and munificence devised the most perfect good for our lives by creating Augustus, filling him with virtue for the benefit of mankind, blessing us and those who come after us with a Savior who put an end to war and established peace, and whereas Caesar, when he appeared, surpassed the hopes of all who had anticipated good tidings, not only surpassing the benefactors before him, but not even leaving any hope of surpassing him to those to come. And whereas the birthday of the God was the beginning for the world of good tidings through him. Augustus is here clearly referred to as a God who brings salvation to the inhabitants of Asia Minor. He provides benefactions along the lines of what the gods bring. And he is deserving of the sort of honors that gods receive. They then go on to say, therefore, with good fortune and for our own safety, it has been decreed by the Greeks of Asia to begin the new year in all the cities on September 23rd, which is the birthday of Augustus. So here's this very strong language of honors and the acknowledgement that the benefactions that Augustus has brought are the equivalent of salvation in this down-to-earth way of understanding salvation in the Roman Empire that we're already learning about from our understanding of how God saved people. And the language of salvation is being used here, that Augustus has brought peace to the world in the language that's being used here. So much so that his benefactions can not be matched by any other human being is the way it's being spoken of. So much so that it's the equivalent of the sort of benefactions that the gods bring. So there's an example of the Council of Asia, that provincial organization at work. I want to also mention briefly another inscription we have that shows that associations might sometimes be involved in the official celebrations associated with the provincial imperial cult. Most associations were not involved. However, one particular group that was involved on more than one occasion in honoring the emperors within the official provincial imperial cults were the hymn singers, the hymnodoi, that we find at Pergamon and in some other locations in the cities of Asia. These hymn singers were also an association that had its own private, you could say, or local sort of inner group activities in honor of the emperors as gods, but on certain occasions, on very specific festivals associated with honoring Augustus and Roma at Pergamum, these hymn singers would come together and do a very special honor for the god Augustus, in honoring him through singing hymns. And here's a portion of the inscription that refers to this practice in the mid-first century CE. Since it is proper to offer a visible exhibition of piety and of every intention befitting the sacred to the Sebastos household, to the revered household each year, the hymn singers from all Asia, coming together in Pergamon for the most sacred birthday of God Augustus, Tiberius Caesar, accomplished a magnificent work for the glory of the association, hymning the revered household, accomplishing sacrifices to the Sebastoi gods, the revered gods, leading festivals and banquets, and then the inscription breaks off here. But here we have a clear sign of a particular association involving itself in the official provincial imperial cult festival on that birthday of Augustus that we were just talking about here. And they also engaged in sacrifices to the Sebastoi gods and festivals and banquets in connection with this as a way of honoring Augustus as a god. Let's talk briefly about civic cults. One of the most well-excavated examples of this civic level, this third level that we're talking about, the municipal or civic level of imperial cults, is the Sebastion at Aphrodisias. Civic cults would be established by local wealthy families who contributed funds in order to build a sanctuary or a temple in honor of the emperors as gods. And so that's what the Sebastion at Aphrodisias is an example of, this sort of civic cult. There's actually an excellent website that you should check out yourself that includes many, many of the inscriptions that have been found at Aphrodisias. You can type in the keyword inscriptions of Aphrodisias in Google and you'll find this website that's run by the University College of London. It's an absolutely amazing website that includes all the inscriptions and includes a description of the inscriptions, a translation of the inscriptions, and photographs of many, many inscriptions, including those that were found in connection with the Sebastion. What we know from the inscriptions that were found at the Sebastion at Aphrodisias is the dedication of this building. It was dedicated to Aphrodite and to the Sebastoi gods, those revered gods, the emperors as gods, as Olympians, and to the Deimos, the people of Aphrodisias. So once again, the prominence of the patron deity of a city comes across, even in connection with the dedication of this temple for the emperors. But what's amazing here is the way in which the emperors are, once again, the Sebastoi that we've been talking about, the revered ones, are being identified with Olympian deities, with traditional Olympian deities in the dedication. Now, what R.R.R. Smith has shown is that the many reliefs that were found in connection with this temple at Aphrodisias likewise show the way in which the emperors are integrated into the mythological sort of framework, integrated within the worldview with the gods alongside the emperors, and that the emperors are here depicted as gods who bring great benefactions to the human communities in Asia Minor and to Aphrodisias itself, and that these gods were considered among the protectors of Aphrodisias alongside their patron deity, Aphrodite. And so you can read more about this civic cult by looking up articles by R.R.R. Smith. We don't have time right now to go into that much more, and I would recommend you read further on that. Friesen also has a good section on the Sebastion at Aphrodisias and these reliefs in his book on imperial cults that I mentioned earlier. Let me talk about the fourth main level, the fourth main type of honors and for the emperors as gods, namely local cults and associations. I have done considerable research that shows that the emperors were integrated as gods within many, many associations in Asia Minor. And you can read up on that in my book, Associations, Synagogues, and Congregations. But right now, I just want to give you one example of the emperors being honored as gods alongside other gods within the internal life of some associations in Asia Minor. I want to use the example of the worshippers of the goddess Demeter at Ephesus that we have evidence for in more than one inscription, and we have evidence that the emperors in a continuing way were part of the honors for the gods that took place within this particular group, and that alongside their official patron deity, the goddess of grain, Demeter, they also honored the emperors as gods, and that this was sacrifices and other cultic activities that were done in the relationship between humans and gods, were done in relation to the emperors within this particular group. We first hear of this group from Ephesus in the period about 19 to 23 CE in Tiberius's time, in one inscription that is fragmentary. And here we have evidence that already by the early first century, this particular group honored members of the imperial family in particular ways. We know that this group had a priest of the new Dioscoroi, and they identified these gods, these Dioscoroi gods, with the sons of Drusus Caesar, members of the imperial family. We also know that they had a priestess of Sebaste Demeter Karpophoros. So already in the early first century, this group identified its main patron deity, Demeter, with the wife of Augustus, with a member of the imperial family as a god. And so we see early on the integration of the imperial family within the sort of divine honors that we find within this particular group. What's more fascinating, though, is an inscription we have from about 88 or 89 CE. A few decades later, we still see the emperors and imperial family as important components in the divine honors that take place within this particular group. And this inscription is known as I Ephesus 2:13. And this is a letter to the proconsul of Asia. Now, just to give you a quick background here, it was common practice for various cities, communities, groups of all kinds to try and engage in diplomacy with important officials, and so that they would seek recognition for the practices they engaged in, regardless of what those practices may be. And that there was this desire to have officials recognize the honors you engaged in within your group. And that's what we have here with the members of the Association of Demeter Worshippers at Ephesus writing to Lucius Mestrius Florus, the proconsul of Asia, the official governor of this province of Asia. And here we have description of some of the activities they have in their group that are honors for the emperors as gods. Let me read the inscription. To Lucius Mestrius Florus, proconsul, from Lucius Pompeius Apollonius of Ephesus. Mysteries and sacrifices are performed each year in Ephesus, Lord, to Demeter Carpophoros, the fruit-bearer, and Thesmophoros, the bringer of order, and to the Sebastoi gods, the revered gods, the emperors as gods, by initiates with great purity and lawful customs, together with the priestesses. In most years, these practices were protected by kings and emperors, as well as the proconsul of the period, as contained in their enclosed letters. So they had previous letters in which they had engaged in diplomacy with officials who recognized the practices they engaged in. Accordingly, as the mysteries are pressing upon us during your time of office, through my agency, the ones obligated to accomplish the mysteries, necessarily petition you, Lord, in order that, acknowledging their rights, ... The inscription ends there. But what's fascinating here is that mysteries and sacrifices are performed within this small association in Ephesus in honor of both their patron deity, Demeter, and in honor of the emperors as gods. These sacrifices are not just sacrifices on behalf of the emperors. They are sacrifices to the emperors. This is a clear indication of honors for the gods being addressed to the emperors within a small group locally. Not only that, but there all are also mysteries in honor of both Demeter and the Sebastoi gods that are being referred to here. We know that mysteries were among the most important ways of honoring the gods in the Roman imperial period, and we'll learn more about mysteries in the coming episodes. Now, if this were the only example of an association engaging in sacrifices, and in this case, even mysteries in honor of the emperors, we might say this is a bit of an anomaly. However, we have plenty of evidence that shows that this is far more widespread among these small local groups in various parts of Asia Minor. For example, even that group of hymn singers that I mentioned earlier, who once in a while were involved in the official provincial festival, also internally within their group had regular festivals. This is from an inscription dating to about 110 CE that we have this outline of their various celebrations. These festivals that go on in an ongoing way include this birthday of Augustus, include the New Year's, the Roman New Year's date, January 1st, include the Rose Festival. However, alongside these various festivals, this group also engages in mysteries. And there are hints in the inscription itself as to what is involved. It talks about one of the main leaders of the group, the Eucosmos, the order keeper, will also provide the singers with garlands on the monthly celebration of Augustus' birthday and on the birthdays of the other emperors. And on the days of the mysteries, garlands for their meeting hall and for the members and their sons each day, as well as pastry, incense, and lamps for the rites to the emperor. It seems that the images of the emperor were important within this particular example of imperial mysteries, where within candlelight in this mystery gathering, there would be a revelation of the images of the emperors and or the imperial family. H.W. Pleckett has done a good job of studying this particular inscription, and you can read his article in Harvard Theological Review from back in the mid-60s. We don't have time to go into the many other examples of inscriptions that you can read about in my book that show how the emperors are integrated in many groups at the local level, so much so that you could almost argue that honors for the emperors as gods is grassroots in Roman Asia Minor, and that the emperors are integrated alongside other traditional gods within the activities that take place even at the local level within small groups, and that sacrifices are done to the emperors as gods in the same way that those sacrifices would be done to traditional deities in the same sort of context. I hope you've enjoyed this episode, and I hope you'll come again.